So whenever I talk, I want them to understand this.
この平和公園は、
The Peace Memorial Park,
原爆が投下されるまでは、人々の暮らしがあったんです。
People lived here.
全部廃墟になりました。
Everything was destroyed.
そこに住んでた人は全部から亡くなりました。
Everyone died around this area.
で、この平和公園は今こんなに綺麗な、
Peace Memorial Park is a beautiful park today with so many trees.
これは後から小さな苗木を植えたのが何十年も経ってこんなに大きくなったんです。
Later they planted small trees and after decades these trees became bigger and now a very beautiful park today.
That's Koji Hosokawa speaking in front of the Peace Museum in Hiroshima. As he looked down at the ground, he said, "People lived here. People lived here." To see our whole interview with him when we were in Hiroshima, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. That was Democracy Now!, which you can hear every Monday through Friday from 4 to 5 p.m. And on Mondays now, stay tuned for Disability Beat. But first, a underwriting announcement.
Programming for WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. For a few special invitations printed or thousands of full-color flyers, Minuteman Press can help get it done on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Phone is 217-355-0550. They are located at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign or www.champaignprinting.com.
The parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
So I need to get back into the technical aspects of running a radio program. This is my first one back after 16 months off. And I'm very excited to be back doing Disability Beat. I missed it greatly when I was off for that period of time. And there's a lot to get caught up on. So I want you to stay tuned for an interview with Ed and Ellen McManus, parents of an adult daughter with disabilities. And I expect that you will learn a lot from listening to them. I always do. But first, disability news for the week of August 6, 2018. President Donald Trump has signed into law bipartisan legislation that will delay until 2020 the start of a Medicaid requirement that personal care attendants electronically check in when they assist people with disabilities. The one-year delay of what's known as electronic visit verification, or EVV, was sought by a number of disability rights groups, largely because of concerns about privacy and the timeline for states to comply with the mandate, which was originally slated to take effect in January of 2019. While praising the new law, some advocates said they want to see more legislation passed to narrow the reach of EVV. Said Nicole Jorwick, Director of Rights Policy for the ARC of the U.S., quote, "We were grateful to see that the EVV delay legislation became law. It's a good first step of fixing the underlying issues that we have seen around implementation at the state level around the country," end quote. While many states are still working on their rollout plans, Ohio launched a controversial system that uses repurposed military-grade cell phones with GPS that are supposed to be carried by clients wherever and whenever they receive disability services. In the spring, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued guidance that addressed privacy, saying that states are not required to use GPS tracking, but states also have wide latitude on what type of technology to use. Allison Barkoff, director of advocacy for the Center for Public Representation, said, quote, "We are going to need to work with Congress on a bill to address the most egregious concerns. The biggest concerns on the privacy front are the requirement that the location be tracked. We'd like for Congress to prohibit the use of things like GPS," end quote. The requirement for EVV was part of the 21st Century Cures Act, which was passed by Congress in late 2016. The intent was to curb Medicaid fraud by verifying when services were provided. CMS has said one goal is to ensure more consistent, higher quality care, but that those changes could create uncertainty for an individual who is used to things being done a certain way. New research suggests that technology developed by Google may be able to help unlock social abilities and lessen symptom severity in children with autism. In a study published on Thursday, researchers at Stanford University found that kids with autism made more eye contact and were better able to relate to others after participating in an at-home therapy that used Google Glass, essentially computerized eyeglasses equipped with a camera, small screen, and speaker in conjunction with a custom smartphone app. The gains were seen after just 1 to 3 months of regular use, according to findings published in the journal Digital Medicine. For the study, 14 children with autism participated in the therapy dubbed Superpower Glass for 20 minutes three times a week for an average of 10 weeks. They wore Google Glass devices that were connected to an app that relied on machine learning to recognize 8 emotions: happiness, sadness, anger, disgust, surprise, fear, neutral, and contempt, based on facial expressions. Parents completed questionnaires and interviews before and after their children took part in the therapy. Overall, they indicated that the technology was useful and fun, and a dozen of the families reported that their kids showed more eye contact after being involved in the study. Researchers acknowledged that the study was small and lacked a control group, but indicated that the findings are promising, especially in light of the long waits children typically experience before accessing autism treatment. A larger randomized trial is currently underway. And finally, a federal agency responsible for community living is reaffirming its mission following allegations that a top official publicly stated that she favored segregation of people with disabilities. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Community Living said it is committed to making community living possible for all. The assertion comes in a letter to members of Congress weeks after the agency's principal deputy administrator, Mary Lazar, spoke at 2 disability group conferences. A similar set of remarks during both appearances left some advocates alarmed and sparked concerns from a bipartisan group of federal lawmakers. In letters sent to Lance Robertson, who heads the Administration for Community Living, last month, the lawmakers said they were told that Lazar indicated that the Supreme Court came to the wrong conclusion in the landmark Olmstead versus LC case, which affirmed the right of people with disabilities to access community-based living. There are believed to be no recordings of the appearances which Lazar made at conferences put on by the Autism Society and the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities during the same day in July. However, later that day, Lazar seemed to back away from her own words through a statement on the Administration for Community Living's Twitter page. The statement read, quote, "I regret and apologize for my words at the conference. ACL believes people with disabilities have the right and choice to live in the community. We work to expand those opportunities and are 100% committed to that mission. We also recognize Olmsted gives people the right to other choices. Now, in a written response to members of Congress, ACL's Robertson is denying that Lazar expressed the alleged views. Robertson wrote, as, quote, as you know, Principal Deputy Administrator Mary Lazar spoke on July 11th at two events. We know portions of her remarks caused concerns, which we are happy to address. I want to assure you that she did not state or intend to express the opinions referenced in your letter. At ACL, we believe community living should always be the expectation. An integral part of our mandate is to uphold those rights guaranteed in the Americans with Disabilities Act and reinforced through the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Olmsted versus LC, which we fully support, end quote. In addition, Robertson said his agency remains firmly committed to supporting the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in implementing a Medicaid rule outlining what types of settings qualify as community-based. The lawmakers had indicated that Lazar reportedly said the rule should be revisited. Even with the response, U.S. Representative Jim Langevin of Rhode Island said he remains unsatisfied. According to Langevin, quote, despite the agency's assertion that Ms. Lazar did not state or intend to express the opinions referenced in our letter, I remain concerned that we receive no additional information or clarification on her original remarks. People with disabilities deserve to be fully included in society, and any suggestion to the contrary is simply unacceptable. And that's the news for this week. Okay, technology continues to be a challenge, so we're not going to have the music interlude, but I do want to take a moment to, before we start our interview with the McManus family, to honor the memory of Renee Angela James, who passed away Saturday after a courageous battle with cancer. Angela fought diligently for a better life for her adult child with autism. She was also active here at WEFT, hosting one of our morning menu programs until she was too ill to continue. We will all remember her with great love. And now I am pleased to introduce my guests for today, Ed and Ellen McManus, who are from, you're from WillMed, is that correct? Ed and Ellen, are you there? Let's try it now. Ellen, Ed and Ellen, you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Okay, great. So I just introduced you. Why don't you, you're from WillMed, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't we start out by, Ellen, why don't you just say a little bit about who you are, and Ed can do the same, and then we'll, I have a few questions for you, okay?
Okay. Okay, I'm Ellen, and we have lived here in WillMed, Illinois, for 42 years, the same number of years that our daughter is old, but we will be talking about today. It has been a beautiful community for us and a beautiful community for our daughter.
And Ed?
And I'm Ed McManus, and I worked for the Department of Human Services for many years, about 17 years, and in the Division of Developmental Disabilities, and I retired 7 years ago, and then since then I've been operating a consulting practice for provider agencies as well as families, and it's a great way to retire.
And I know I personally have gained so much information just from talking to the two of you on different occasions and you know, hearing you talk about the system as a whole and your work with your daughter specifically. And I wanted to invite you because I've heard you talk about, you know, the Department of Human Services and Division of Developmental Disabilities and all the ramifications of things going on there. But what I really wanted to explore today was the advocacy that you have done for your daughter, Laura, over the years. And I can't believe she's 42. Can you?
My body knows, though.
Your body knows. Okay, so let's start by talking about who Laura is and what her challenges are, what her gifts are, and what your dreams for her have been over the last 42 years. And I don't care who starts.
Okay, I guess I'll start. Laura was born in Springfield, Illinois, and her birth diagnosis was delayed development at that time. And keep in mind that 42 years ago, things were so much different than they are now as far as being able to find out the diagnosis. She didn't have, there wasn't a CAT scan available, and then a year later there was an adult CAT scan that did determine that she was born with cerebral palsy. And this is brand new world for us. We are probably seen cerebral palsy in the books, but never related to it, and certainly didn't know what a developmental disability was. So our resource was the library, not our computers. And at that time, they didn't have any programs for children that young or babies that young from 0 to 3. Those programs were not there and available. So the only one that was available in our area was Northwestern Speech and Language Clinic in Evanston, which was a wonderful resource. But I had to bang down the doors to get her in because they were not used to a mother calling at this early age to get her in. I think I started after 3 months or so. And finally, just, I think, to get rid of me, they agreed to take her. she was 15 months by then. So you can imagine today if someone was told, they actually told me to wait until 18 months. So that's where they were with understanding the lack of how important it is to get on to services and help as soon as possible. So she had a wonderful program and wonderful therapist at Northwestern. And then when she became of age at 3, she did begin to enter the school system. And I'm going to let Ed now take over.
Well, she was enrolled in those days, most of the programs were segregated. So she was enrolled in a program up in Lake County. We live in Cook County, so she had to be bused up there. And then after a number of years, we actually placed her in a children's group home. And then after a couple of years, we decided to bring her home. Is this what you wanted me to do, Ellen?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, can you talk a little bit about why you decided to place her in the children's group home, and then why you decided to remove her from that situation?
Yeah, we were advised by some professionals to do that, and in retrospect, I think it was bad advice. But we didn't know, we didn't have a clue, like mm-hmm. so many families are. We like Ellen said, we didn't even know what a developmental disability was, and so we took their advice and we placed her, but we just weren't very happy with the quality of care there. So then we were fortunate in being able to convince the state, and actually it was Janelle Voigt from Community Alternatives Unlimited that steered us in the right direction with all this. And we convinced the state to allow the money that was being spent at that group home to be transferred to us, and then we brought her home. But not just us, we created what is now called a microboard. We never heard of that term, but I mean, Janelle came up with the idea that we could form our own board of directors made up of our friends and form a nonprofit, and the state was more comfortable with that because they could give the money so they gave the money to the nonprofit, and that enabled us to hire workers to care for Laura in the home.
And how old was she at this point? Was she still
12? We placed her at 10, and we brought her home 2 years later at 12. Then she lived with us until she was 22. But then, in the meantime, she was one of the good things about the group home, which was out in Wheaton, was that she was integrated out there, and was a wonderful integrated school system. And then she came back here to the northern suburbs, to the segregated system. So then we decided to challenge that, and we ended up in 4 years of litigation, and we finally prevailed. And then she, by that time, she was in high school, and she was really the first child with a severe disability that was integrated into New Trier High School.
And you made it sound like that was so easy. Was it?
Are you kidding? It was a really, really difficult 4 years, because we would go in for due process hearings, and we would have to deal with the teachers that were working with her every day who were testifying against us.
Oh, gosh.
And we had to bring in experts, all of which volunteered their time to us. And the expert witness, along with an excellent lawyer, the first due process hearing, we won, and then the second one we didn't, and then it was ready to go to the 7th District Court. Is that correct, Ed?
No, just the U.S. District Court in Chicago.
Just.
And so anyway, we ended up, we won that level that she could, well, then the school challenged that. We wanted the school challenged that, and then she had to stay in the place that she was in while we were fighting for her to be integrated. And time was flying by, and it was getting near to her graduating. So half of the day, the settlement was half of the day, she did go to an integrated program, and the other half of the day, she was in a segregated setting. And then the time went by with regard to the due process, and then she was ready to enter high school. And then the high school started all over and challenged us. And by then, our lawyer, who had done a lot of this pro bono, had said that he would have to bow out, and it was up to us what we wanted to do. So Ed decided that he would act as the lawyer, and we challenged the high school, and that took them by surprise, and they backed down, and they wanted to settle. Hmm. And so then the settlement was that she could go full-time to New Trier, and that would have been her home school. And then that experience in her high school was just absolutely wonderful, and it made, I think, an impact on her after-school life.
And in the meantime, I was elected to the Wilmette School Board, and everybody thought that I ran for the board because of this case, or because of Laura, but it really wasn't, it didn't have anything to do with that. But at any rate, it became pretty awkward, because whenever the board would want to discuss our case, I'd have to leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just kind of weird, you know.
So what were the positive outcomes for Laura as a result of her being in that integrated setting?
Well, I just absolutely think it was a wonderful experience for her, particularly the students who were in the regular program, and she was sitting side by side with them in the advisory room and in some of the classes in which I am a former teacher, and I just took it upon myself to adapt some of the curriculum to fit what I felt would be meaningful to Laura. And so the students, you know, were always sort of the advocates for her. And I remember she was in a cooking class, and I don't know what the teacher was asking her to do, but it was something very boring. And the students stood up for her, and they said, there's no reason why she can't dump the ingredients in a bowl and stir it and have more fun with it. And so then what could the teacher do other than nod her head, because this was coming from the students? And they were always there to kind of advocate for her. They were always interested in her, in her disability. And then as she grew toward near graduation, they wanted to know what was going to happen to her. And, of course, they were making their college plans. And I happened to be there one day when they were asking the questions. And I said, well, she's in the process of trying to buy her own condo. And that flipped them out. It was sort of like this such larger picture that they couldn't even dream of, that she was already looking for a condo and they were still going to school. So it was just really a delightful experience all the way through for the most part.
Those kids have all grown up now and got married and had their own children, and then they come back to Wilmette and they run into Laura on the street, and it's just so neat that after all these years that they still remember Laura. You know?
Oh, yeah. I believe that.
Yeah, to this day, they'll just go right up, start talking to her, you know, whether we're there or her staff caregiver is there, it doesn't matter. They're there to talk with Laura. They feel very comfortable talking to her. And the beautiful part of it is that Laura is nonverbal. That has never stood in the way. They just developed a relationship as they, you know, as she related to them and they related back to her and she responded. So it was quite remarkable.
Laura can't walk and she can't talk, so she's in a wheelchair. But then when she aged out of school at 22, we were able to get Scylla funding, but not the regular group home. It was the what's known as shared living, where she was placed with. She got money from her grandma to buy a condo, and then she was able to live there with a roommate plus a live-in caregiver.
And this was supported through the funds that you had acquired from the children's group home that she had gone to previously.
Well, that was when she was home with us. When she was home with us for 10 years, our organization was able to hire workers to come in and take care of her. And then at 22, she became part of the regular Scylla system.
Yeah, it is true that the money that she had from the group home that was awarded to her was the money that followed her home, which we worked hard on getting. And then when she was graduating from high school and we wanted to take that money and have it, it was a demonstration project, so the money was a little bit easier to keep transferring as she grew to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that level, they were fairly receptive to it on the part of Department of Human Services, because they then could take it and get it federally matched with half from the state and half from the federal government.
So the funding that she has is from Scylla, which is Community Integrated Living Arrangement, and that's the funding stream that supports group homes in the state of Illinois. So how did you manage to get the state to allow your organization, it's somewhat of a micro board, but you know, that must have been a challenge as well to make that happen and to allow Laura to live in her own condo.
Well, no, actually the micro board part was only while she was still living at
okay, home. Okay.
From the age of 12 to the age of 22, the micro board hired workers that came into our home to care for her after school and on weekends. And then when she graduated, then that was when she moved into the condo, and she was just like anyone else who gets state funding, and actually it was much easier to get 20 years ago than it is now.
Sure.
And so then she was able to get complete state funding, and we had an organization called Neighborhood Services who specialized in this special kind of group home that really isn't a group home because it's just two individuals plus the live-in caregiver.
Right. Which, I mean, that's a challenge in itself. I mean, just doing things differently.
Yeah.
It was a shared living model, and it does still exist here in the state of Illinois, but there's very few of them. And in other states throughout the country, there are lots of them because this is primarily what families like, because it is like establishing an extended family.
Right, right. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time. Ed, if you want, I know that Ed is a consultant and does a lot of work with agencies in the state of Illinois. If you want to quickly give your contact information, any last words, and I'm going to have to call it a close for today.
Yeah, the name of my organization is McManus Consulting, and you can find me on Facebook. And if you look at me on Facebook, you can also find my email and my phone number.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me, Ed and Ellen McManus, parents of Laura.
You're welcome, Vicki.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week.